360 Yourself is a dedicated podcast meeting brilliant minds and looking at the world around them. How do they 360 themselves and 360 the world? Jamie Neal, the host, asks many questions about their mindset and how they fundamentally operate their world and the world around them. Here at 360 Yourself, we are very proud and honored to be partnered with General Assembly. We embrace this with open arms to a new adventure. General Assembly is a global tech education company focused on the most in-demand areas today. So that's anything from UX, digital marketing, coding, data science, data analytics, to travel writing and ethics. Our/their main goal is to get you where you want to be. You can find out more about them at ga.co online or across all socials at ga_London. We also encourage you to please rate and comment about us on Apple Podcasts. If you do enjoy what we bring to your ears, we'd love to hear about it. We're supported by General Assembly, and that's right, you can get a 25% discount for their services. Promo code is 360yourself25. The code will be valid up to £75 off any one of their classes, workshops and boot camps, and is valid until the 31st 08 2021, and is not applicable to GA's full-time, part-time or online circuit courses. Full T's and C's apply. Hello and welcome back to 360 Yourself. I hope you're having a good morning, good afternoon, good evening. You have me, the host, Jamie Neal. So, again, we're back again for another episode of 360 Yourself with another brilliant guest to delve into their minds and see what they do and how they see themselves, even potentially what's their favourite food. Or my favourite question of all is, what animal could you be if you had a choice? Like, I love that. I think someone asked me this the other day, and I was like, when I was younger, this is a very simple question, or simple answer. I was like, I would like to be a cheetah, only because they're fast. And now over the years, I potentially would like to be a meerkat. Like, I'm just a bit tall. I was very lanky when I was younger, so couldn't really use my arms because my arms are quite long. I don't know, like the quickness of them. I love meerkats. They're so fascinating. And also, I'm a big, big lover of Lion King. And I just love the character in that with Nathan Lane playing, is it Timon, I think it is? Yeah, Timon. Yeah, Timon. That was also, on a side note, when I was younger, I always wanted to be Timon in Lion King. Like, that was something that I really wanted to do. Unfortunately, it didn't happen. But if anyone who is the Lion King producers or the director and you're listening to this, I'd love an audition. just to pretend to play Timon. Anyway, something that I've been reading, and a lot of people have been exploring this a lot more, is this idea of having cold showers. And it's called hydrotherapy. There's loads of benefits to it. Increases endorphins. It helps your metabolism. I think that's how you say it. Metabolism? I think that's what I say. But it's just really, really good for you. And it improves the circulation. It helps fight off common illnesses and stuff. And obviously, you can't do a full 2 minutes straight away. You've got to build up to it, like 10 seconds. Then you go to 30 seconds. But this morning, I did 15 seconds. I did do 15 seconds. I swear I did. And it was obviously very, very cold. But I'm trying to get into a routine of doing it, even though I'm a very, very hot person. I love hot climates. People always say to me, what is the difference between hot and cold? And I'm like, well, cold in my mind is like basically like dying. It's awful. Hot, I'd rather be really, really hot, melting, and still kind of like doing my life. I don't know. I just hate the cold so much. And everyone knows me knows if I had an option to go to like Bali or Sri Lanka or like Iceland, I would honestly just pick the Sri Lanka, and I'd pick Bali because it's really, really hot. Also, I just love the scenes there. I love the scenery. It looks amazing. So, but yeah, hopefully this has convinced you just to try 10 seconds because it is really good for you and the exercises are really great and there's lots of benefits for your health as well. Anyway, so moving on, we've got an amazing DP, which is basically a director of photography. I've known his work for a long time. We'll also share the same agent at United Agents. So I thought, why not get him on? He's done amazing work for Paco Rabanne, Valentino, Jill Sander, Givenchy. I mean, the list goes on. He's also done Chanel. He's like one of the top DPs in the industry of advertising. He's been doing it for 30 years. And I'd love to introduce you to Simon. Hey, Simon, how are you doing?
I'm doing very well, Jamie.
Good.
Sleep deprived, but all good.
Aren't we all, though? I feel like I've been talking to a lot of people recently, and I think in the last maybe 2-3 weeks, I think workload has definitely shifted in the filmmaking world and the creative world compared to what it has been since January. I think there was a bit of a slump, and then suddenly everyone has gotten really, really busy.
Yes.
Maybe it's better to be busy, though, than be quiet, isn't it?
Yes. Absolutely. Better to be stressed than to be bored, though boredom is always appreciated.
Yeah. So
if you can mix your boredom with your stress, it's like having a dish with a little bit of spice in it, or one of those, was it called umami?
Umami.
Is that the word?
Yeah.
So you're fine with your rice, but you need some umami with it as well.
Yeah.
So, you can't do a whole load of either.
This is very true. So going on that, then, when you do have potentially quiet moments, are you very productive in those quiet moments, or are you very much like, because obviously
useless? I thought when all this bollocks started last year, I thought, I know what I'm going to do. I'm going to write that comic novel I've always promised myself, because I have nothing profound to say. So I thought if I was going to write something, it would be comic. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't. And then I had hours of just mindless staring out of the window, and I never got round to writing the comic novel. So I just realized I'm essentially a lazy person who has to be incredibly unlazy at work.
I love that. Maybe not now, but maybe in the future this comic novel will come out or something. I don't know.
I'd hope so. I arranged, when we were allowed out of our cages last time, I arranged meetings with friends, and we would have to kind of sit in public parks because that was mm-hmm. always available. Mm-hmm. And one friend had no financial assistance at all because he, like a lot of us, had limited companies, and he was paying himself out of dividends, which is an entirely legitimate strategy given that who knows when you have work, we don't have crystal balls. Mm-hmm. So he had no financial help. And I said, how are you surviving? And he said, well, I'd saved up some money. That was my pension. So I guess I'm retired now. And I think we all experienced what it was like being retired.
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, God, really? I thought I just got to carry on working till I drop because I don't think I'm up for this.
I know. It's weird, isn't it? Like people, I mean, talking about something about politics, but it's weird how like the self-employed grants just didn't really cater for people who had limited companies. Because I had loads of friends who have these massive bills for rents and studios and stuff, and usually they're on very good money, but suddenly they're in this situation and they had to really dip into their savings.
Let's not go too far there, but it was an astonishing decision.
Yeah.
Yes. Everyone managed to get work as a delivery driver or a taxi driver or whatever.
Mm-mm-mm. But again, you were the lucky one.
No, because I'd been working like a fool to pay for the renovation of this apartment, and I had some savings.
That's very handy.
Yeah.
A friend of mine always says you need get out jail card money, basically like a pot of money. If you ever need to just go away anywhere, you've got it. And she told me it's about 4 years ago, and I never really understood it. And then I started doing it, like maybe like a year ago. I started just putting money aside, like not for anything, just for like if I ever needed it. And then it came really. I did a big global campaign just for Christmas, and I was like, okay, this is a large chunk of money. Put that most of that away, and then obviously COVID came around, and I was like, I'm so glad I put some money away just in case, because. Again, when you are busy, usually, I mean, you probably are always busy and you're always flying everywhere. You maybe don't think about putting bits and pieces away because there's always some money away. Oh, do you?
No, I'm very, for someone as catastrophe minded as myself, it's odd. I didn't see this coming. No, I'm always assuming that it's going to stop next year. That this year is my last. No, I'm always fearful. So, which I think that's one of my motors for working.
It's funny though how I listen to a lot of podcasts of very successful people who being that they're directors, DPs, actors, and they all say the same thing at that with that height that they always think that this will be the last one. Like this is it. This is probably gonna be the last one, and I probably won't be able to do that one. Do you think there's something in that with people who are successful that they think that's going to be the last one and they might not get another chance to do what they want to do?
Yeah. Okay. I think we live in a very brutal industry that's a little bit like Logan's Run, that you can get so far and then you're taken away and exterminated off-site somewhere. So your dying doesn't upset the younger people. And I think, whoever you are, there's a whole line of people behind you waiting to take your position.
For sure.
And that we have to be enormously aware of the dangers of being complacent.
Mm-hmm. This is so true.
It's however much experience you have, you should still be walking onto set with a whole load of energy and curiosity and a desire to push forward and push the shoot forward and push yourself and push other people. So it's quite bloody exhausting.
It is. Apparently, Tom Hanks, though, is that sort of person. Even after so long of doing it, apparently he's literally just like a boy on set. Like he's just
so... Are we thinking of Tom Hanks or Tom Cruise?
No, Tom Hanks.
Tom Hanks, fascinating. Yeah,
Tom
okay.
Hanks. I don't know about Tom Cruise, but like he did that massive.
I've heard
crazy...
stories.
Oh, have you? Because he did that. He did that crazy rant, didn't he, about COVID, which I think was definitely called for, because obviously there's a lot riding on that sort of situation. But like
I'm saying nothing about that.
Yeah, of course. But I meant Tom Hanks, because he's really like energetic, and every time people talk to him on interviews, he's so full of life and just absolutely loves his job and loves being on set. And I think as you said, rightly as you said, like people been doing it for 20, 30, 40 years, you got to do it like the first time you did it when you were younger, and you got to have that sort of mentality to always kind of explore and keep things alive.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely.
So going back, I would love to know how it all started. How did you fall into DP work?
Okay. I think when I was a teenager, I was sick at home, and there was an open universities type program on, and they had film clips from pieces by Bunuel and Eisenstein, and I'd never seen filmmaking like that, and it really caught my eye and stayed with me. I feel, you know, very, very lucky to have seen. It was Battleship Potemkin, the steppe sequence, and Orshine, I don't know, so the Andalusian dog. I'm sorry, I won't insult French listeners by trying to pronounce it, with the eye slitting
sequence. Yeah.
And then about the same time, there was a repeat of one of the series of Monty Python on television. And we would all us kind of irritating boys would watch it and then repeat throughout the following day's German lesson to the mm-hmm. torment of the German teacher, mm-hmm. or the very kind of ridiculous things that we'd heard the night before. And I think just a little later, my older brother came home with Are We Not Men, We Are Devo, the album. Mm-hmm. So all of these with the music, the comedy, and then the seeing these film clips, it occurred to me, and it was particularly with Devo, it was, there's a standard way of doing something. There's a standard way of arranging a song and playing a song. Mm-hmm. But then with a band like that, what they seem to do is take it apart and rearrange it. Mm-hmm. In perverse and unusual ways. And it's the same with Monty Python. At the time, that's what it seemed like. Mm-hmm. So you have a structure, but then you turn it inside out and rearrange it to be startling and interesting and absurd. And I thought, oh, there's the world as it seems and all these conventional ways of doing things and thinking about things, but there's this other approach which is infinitely more interesting and mm-hmm. illuminating. And that, I suppose, caught my interest. I did conventional academic A-levels, but it was obviously I was going to do very, very badly in them. So I stayed an extra year and did art and art history, and then went to art school, where I met, as one does, other interested people and mm-hmm. collaborated with them. Mm-hmm. And that led me into a not very successful directing career, making kind of so-so videos. And that, from being a not very successful director, I started shooting little bits of other people's videos mm-hmm. on either Super 8, but when the Super 8 laboratories closed down, on a Clockwork Bolex camera, 16mm camera. Mm-hmm. And then after a while, people said, well, why not, instead of just being the second unit, shooting away in a corner or shooting cutaways or whatever it was, why don't you shoot the whole thing? So then I was having to ring up the lighting company, the electric lighting company in Bow, and say, that big light that looks like lots of car headlights, what's that called? Oh, that's a Dino. You can have 24 bulbs or 12 bulbs or 9 bulbs. Okay, which one do you think I ought to have? And that spotlight, the one that's like tungsten, but really powerful, what's that called? So I learned on the job. I was never a camera assistant. It's always with a new camera, I have to be told where the on button is and all the rest of it. And I have to, which thankfully I don't normally have to do, because I always think that's why one has assistants, is yeah. because you don't need to know everything.
Yeah, which a really good DP told me recently, because I was like, how do you know what lens and what camera to use and that sort of thing? Like, I was like, I've got an idea for a shot, but I don't know what I need to use. But like, I've got an idea. And he was like, well, you don't need to know it. You just tell me the type of shot, like it goes over the head, it goes underneath the ground, it goes through the ear, whatever. Like, that's my responsibility. And then if I don't know, someone else will know.
Absolutely. I remember when because I was doing this kind of second unit camera stuff, shooting bits of other people's music videos, and I remember I had this moment. It was a night shoot, and the DOP was said to the gaffer, oh, can you make this bit, and he pointed to whatever the location was, can you make that bit a bit darker? And the gaffer just got a C-stand and a Charlie bar and whatever the thing was that the DOP wanted to make, but he made a little shadow there. And I thought, that's really interesting. He hasn't said, I want exactly this. He just said the effect he wants. Mm. I tend to be horribly over-specific. I want this land, this lamp at this height with this diffusion, et cetera, et cetera. I get very much into the detail of it. But sometimes I also think just you don't have to. It often gets people more involved if you're not too specific. It's a mistake I make, of being too exacting.
Yeah.
Sometimes you ask for something.
Yeah.
I want a pancake, and someone will bring you a sliced loaf. And you think, well, I asked for a pancake. Instead of sending the sliced loaf back, let's see what the sliced loaf does. And you think, oh, I can make some toast with that. Sometimes if you have to allow other people to make contributions, you can pass on, because I remember one commercial director saying to me, I want this shot to feel privileged. And you think, what the hell does that mean? That's the kind of toss you write in a treatment to bamboozle an advertising agency into giving you the gig. What does that mean? But if the director just turns and walks away thinking, oh my God, I've got to make this shot feel privileged. What the hell? And you debate it, the burden gets passed to you. Mm. And it's all so much of this work is there's this heavy burden of delivering this glowing, shining bullshit that's been written into a treatment and delivering it on screen. But you don't have to shoulder the whole burden. You can spread it out amongst other people. I would like that to look really shiny. I would like that to look really dark. I mean, I tend to be very specific, but you don't have to be very specific.
Yeah.
It's rather like I have a phrase, the floating ball of anxiety, because you often, within this process of a job being set up, there is an anxiety, and that anxiety gets passed from the client who's worried that the campaign, the product won't sell. So they have this anxiety, which they pass to the advertising agency, and then the agency offloaded it on the director. So he or she is weighed down with the anxiety that comes from entirely somewhere else. And then it gets passed to people like me, and then possibly you can throw that, you can pass it on to other people, but the anxiety makes all kinds of strange manifestations where you can be on set and someone says, oh, the agency says they want this, and you think, why do they want that? And then you think, oh, actually it's you want the loaf to be toasted, and then you have to think, well, actually, what they need is the loaf to be buttered. I don't know. I'm just using these absurd terms rather than technical. But people can start getting very specific with me. Sometimes you think, why? What is? Oh, now I understand. You're worried that the product doesn't look this enough or that enough. Anyway.
Yeah.
You don't have to solve everything yourself. You can pass things on to other people. You can, everyone teamwork. Is there to help. Everyone teamwork. Is there to help. Indeed, yeah. Teamwork.
I remember someone once on set told me, it needs to feel a bit more blue. And I was like, what does... But blue for me, because I'm in my artistic brain, I'm like, blue can mean sad, blue can mean uplifting, blue can mean light, blue can... So for me, because I'm dyslexic, so I visualize a lot of stuff. For me, that would work. I don't like to be too specific.
Yeah.
I like to be quite vague to allow people to have their own imagination and to come up with things. And I'm like, oh, I didn't even think about that. I'm going to take that. Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah.
So going on to kind of your career, I mean, you've had like a massive long career and you've done some brilliant stuff of some films and some short films and mostly commercials and some music videos. Mm-hmm. Before we were talking about, was it a conscious choice to do commercials?
I started off like a lot of people shooting music videos because they were way more informal, there was room to make mistakes, and boy, did I make a lot of mistakes. And then it was a particular music video that I had shot for a band called Electronic with Bernard Sumner and Johnny Marr and someone who owned their own production company, a director called Jeff Stark, liked it and asked me to do 5 Virgin Atlantic commercials with Helen Mirren. And I was entered this world where I could write a lighting list and an equipment list, and everything I requested would be on set. Unlike on a music video where, oh, we can't afford the 10K light you've asked for. Everything, you know, it was difficult, tricky. You couldn't get the lights you wanted, crane. Mm-hmm. You know, director would say, describe a shot. You think, oh, well, that's an anamorphic lens on a Technicrane. And then what you would end up doing would putting a 16mm camera on your shoulder and being pulled back on a wheelchair.
So, I've seen that.
Exactly. So then the world of commercials, you can have the techno crane. You can have the camera that runs at 120 frames a second or 300 frames a second. And your director could walk on set and say, oh, I think for this shot, we need this very, very long zoom. Oh, okay. I didn't ask for the very, very long zoom. Why not? Well, because we're in a studio. Why would we need the long zoom in the studio? Well, I want the long zoom. We need the long zoom. Producer, get me the long zoom. So it's entered this world where everyone, this is in the 90s, I have to say, everyone could have everything. Now, shooting a commercial now is more like shooting a music video in the 90s. Most things are, we can't afford this. We don't have enough time for that. Bore on.
But I think, but I'm assuming it depends on the client, because I'm assuming like the bigger the client, like Apple, Facebook, those sort of things, who have a lot of money. I'm assuming when you're on those sort of jobs, because they got so much money now.
There is a difference. Sometimes you can be very, very fortunate and shoot in an amazing location with all the crew and all the equipment you need. That does still happen. Mm-hmm. And there's the other one where you will not, the biggest drain on my time is on the one day shoot in London.
Yeah, well, they tried to make that, you do
that involves the most emails and phone calls and Zoom conferences and all the rest of it. There are jobs, pleasant as they are, and lovely people and all the rest of it. Where,
yeah, and what do you nowadays? There is, or back in the day, there was just like TVC, and it was just that. It was the main kind of film. But now you've got all the social media stuff. You've got all this extra stuff. How kind of involved in that are you in the conversation? Because obviously you used to be in the main thing, and now you've got all this extra stuff that you need to get all in the same day.
There is the interesting thing of formats, where taking into account your TV commercial will be presented like this, 16:9, mm-hmm. but then you're doing the social media, which we presented like that. But I have to remind myself that way back when, we'd be shooting a commercial for cinema, and we'd also have to frame it for television. So, you know, there were those things. Before we're all masked and hand sanitizing and all this nonsense, you would have making of teams on set. And I'm slightly break away from your question. You'd have a making of team on set, because they'd be doing what's called, as you say, social. So you have the main commercial, but they also want to, the client or the agency wants to scrape something else out of it. So instead of just the 30-second commercial, they want a 4-minute piece to go on YouTube or whatever, mm-hmm. which will feature the making of the commercial, possibly something entirely, you know, shoot a different story within the same set with the same people. That happens. And what I noticed when we have making of teams, that there was this very hierarchy within the set, which would be, we are shooting the commercial, you are shooting the making of.
But that
we
still happens.
Are shooting, yeah. And it was this, I noticed there was this snobbishness about the making of teams. And I was looking at the making of teams, and, you know, at first I was snobby as well. Then I was thinking, hold on, Simon, you were that person in a way, because I was there with my clockwork camera doing second unit or second camera operating on these music videos back in the 90s. Yeah. And I had to put up with an immense amount of shit from electricians who delighted in finding someone from the camera team who they could treat like, you know, they could be appalling to. And sometimes other DOPs really not wanting me on set. So I was looking at the making of teams thinking, oh, actually, in some ways, they're a little bit like I was. But then I also thought this further thought, or more profound thought, which was, oh, maybe people have this problem with the making of team being there because we're all basically ashamed of what we do. We know that we are in an industry of utter nonsense, and these people are bearing witness to our vacuousness, and that's why we're uneasy about them there, because they're bearing witness to what an absolute bunch of wankers we are.
I love that. I personally absolutely love the making of. Like, I kind of prefer it to watching the main thing, because I like some... Honestly, there was the recent one with Chanel, and it was I think it's that director John, and I think Ryan Hefton did the choreography, and I think they were like on the moon or something, and I thought it was...
Oh, Johan Renck, yeah.
Yeah, and I was like, he's really, really cool. And then there was a making of film that came slightly afterwards, and I was like, I was hooked on that, because I was so Because I think maybe because I'm Gemini, I'm curious. I'm fascinated how things come about. So I like watching the main thing, but I'm more fascinated with what happens behind. And I think nowadays with social media, even with personalities and celebrities, people want to see what their personal life is. And that's why people are intrigued to see what actually happens behind closed doors. Because before it was all, there was a curtain in front, and now with social media, the curtain's gone.
Yeah, absolutely. I do wonder if making of is like a form of pornography though, because it leaves out, you watch a making of and it'll be like the crane shot, the whoosh, the crane. Someone saying something amusing, swirling around the set. It's not like someone by a furred tea urn getting some, you know, waiting, you know, trying to find the PG tips bag or telling some astonishingly boring anecdote about getting to an argument with a production manager on a shoot in Cardiff about their per diems or whatever. Or it's all the glam, it's a distillation of everything kind of photogenic and amazing within 3 minutes over what could have been like 12 hours of tedium and frustration. So that's, yes, they have a pornographic, dishonest pornographic.
Yeah. I love your perspective of like battering down this like kind of hierarchy of like filmmaking and stuff. And you're making it sound so real, which it is to us who work in it and the behind scenes. And I love that it's not like commercials and Chanel and oh my God, I'm shooting Chanel commercial. It's just a bunch of people getting together and shooting something that a client has asked them to do.
Yeah, but there's also within our business, I remember someone saying to me, because I do, I'm very, very lucky that I do these luxury brands and I do hair and makeup commercials. Mm. And I remember someone saying to me another day, saying, oh, you do beauty. That is, there is a snobbishness within commercials, within the work that you do, within British commercials, comedy commercials come out top. And then with particular brands, it used to be beer, car, whatever. Mm-hmm. Now it's like you're kind of, I suppose it might be the tech companies. And then things that to do with, and I wondered if there's this slight within Britain, I don't know, I could be entirely paranoid and delusionary, that the slight disdain for if you shampoo ads, lipstick ads, perfume ads, even though you can do a perfume ad, it can be exactly the same level or even more level of craft and even more emphasis on the visual than any other form of commercial. And I did wonder if it was a thing of, these are women's products, we don't take them seriously, you know. But I think British advertising in the past was very, very male in terms of the you might have a one woman, you look over into the corner of Black, you know, stage five at Black Island, and it would be all the so-called creative team would all be men. Mm. And they might have, let's say, one woman amongst them. And I just think there was this very kind of, it was very laddie. And there wasn't much interest and respect for these beauty commercials or, you know, things that were seen as marketed at women.
Yeah. And I think it goes back to, I mean, you've touched upon a really interesting subject about kind of the hierarchy and the kind of ratio within the advertising world. And I think there are more now creative directors and people who are the account holders who are female. But it's fascinating how back in the day, maybe it's different now that car commercials, the sort of masculine sort of things where the kind of things that people really cherish and was like, this is that good commercial, but the same quality and craft of a lipstick commercial or beauty commercial isn't the same kind of thing. I find that really fascinating. I would love to talk about your kind of Instagram sort of stuff. Like you were known within the industry with your DP work in commercials, but what also is brilliant is that you have this amazing kind of fan base that you take these amazing photos of like the behind the scenes with people. I'd love to know how that kind of came about.
Yeah, okay. Thank you for asking me that. I don't know particularly why. I suppose I had this image of myself lying on the ground with a lamp had fallen on me and blood, my head was crushed by the light and blood was seeping out. And I suppose it was in part, I have been on sets where people have been injured and hospitalized and all kinds of unpleasant things. And I wanted to make an image, God knows why, I thought maybe it might be useful on in some way of presenting myself that reflected that. And then I started off taking pictures on set. Everyone walks around with their phone going, oh, mottled paint on a doorway in Buenos Aires, click. View out of my window at the sunset flying to South Africa, click. And they're all very, let's face it, they're all very banal, aren't they? And I thought, oh, there's all this social media stuff. Maybe I ought to sign on to Instagram, you know, because maybe I can swank off about, look at me, I'm shooting in Rome. Hey, I'm in Paris now, and all that kind of tosh. And I quickly realized that I was started this place in the same banal bollocks as everyone else. And I thought, oh, maybe that image I had in my mind, and it just took off. So every time every day I was at work, I'd try and take a picture. And the pictures were a little influenced by Jean-Paul Goud and Philippe Haussmann. And a little bit by the very formal presentation you'd get in a Renaissance painting, maybe like a Uccello, painted by someone like Uccello, if that's where you pronounce. Because I was taking them on the phone, the little iPhone 4, the pictures, the camera couldn't handle that much contrast. So I always try and do them with very flat light and always against a plain background, because on the phone, you can't have too much detail because it's, you know, it needs to be something that's very quickly read. And then an interest in surrealism, an interest in or noticing that sets not only can be physically dangerous, that they're often places of conflict where these egos are involved, where there's a struggle, because there's a question when you're working is who owns the job? And people will say something like, oh, your shot, my shot. Well, is it your shot, my shot, the director's shot, the agency's shot? None of us own any of this stuff.
Yeah.
And we're all coming together to make these pictures. None of us. And there's such confusion about who owns a shot. And I know going from the Instagram pictures, but there's such a confusion about whose work is worthy. If you notice in award ceremonies that the best production design will go to something that's been shot in a series of stately homes, it always does. Or yeah, it'll go to the DOP who shot a film with a lot of sunsets that might have been done by the second unit, because that's what's recognized. You think, by, you know, most people who might go to the cinema or what, Netflix, oh, that's a pretty picture, it's a sunset. Well, that's kind of just pointing the camera at something.
Yeah, yeah.
Just get your production. It's rather, oh, we must give the award to someone who did powdered wigs. Well, actually, the production designer who costume designer who clothes people from a film set in 1996 might have a way harder job than someone who has a film set in 1796 in order to do something entirely convincing. So we get very confused about what, you know, the value of people's work. But there's to go back to the pictures. So it was a desire to do something for myself, because I don't own the pictures. I can shoot something. I can hope that it's graded in a particular way, in a way that I will establish on set with the dit, with, you know, warmer, colder, more contrast, da 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 da. On the monitors, hope that goes through to the rushes, hope that goes through to the final grade. But I have no control of that, because I'm just the DOP. I'm not the person paying for it. So I wanted to do pictures that reflected these clashes of egos on set, reflected the dangerous nature of what we do, but also in an ironic, surreal, hopefully funny way.
Although it does come across, though. It comes across, and one of my favorite pictures is when I think it's either you or someone's up against the wall and the camera's really in your face, and
me.
It's really, really, really great. It's really lovely, and I think I think from an outside point of view, it must be so beautiful and nice for the crew to have like a bit of fun on these commercials, because everyone knows as well, commercials can be sometimes less creative than a music video. And so it must be so nice for them to have.
No, sort absolutely. Of a creative thing. They very often, people are very keen to be in the pictures. But the problem is, the more people are in the picture, the harder they are to take, particularly being in the pictures myself. So I can't always see what other people are doing. So yes, they can be a great energy boost to people, because sometimes shoots can go on a little bit. I've done a few where I've noticed the crew losing interest, that they lose faith in the director, and you feel the energy level in the room rather going down. And then I might have had an idea for a picture, get it, you know, within a 10-minute break, and then everyone has such fun doing it, they go back to the job with renewed energy and vigor and all the rest of it. And maybe I do too. People very much enjoy being in them. Maybe the best thing with people, if they're curious, to see them rather than me trying to describe what they are in a pictorial context. But they're normally about violence. One time, actually, I got attacked. It's very interesting for me. I had a Jordan Peterson moment. I got attacked on an Instagram. Someone reposted a collection of my pictures saying, "I wish these pictures were ironic, but they're not." Wow. It's a celebration of violence and bullying and misogyny. I mean, all these other things. I think, I'm really, are you sure about them? All these other issues got brought into them. I think I'm a bit confused about this, but the thing that was the funniest, "I wish these pictures were ironic, but they're not." I was thinking, oh, I must have really failed them, because for me, they're all about irony. I'm so sorry. It's that fascinating thing. It's
perspective.
And I think a lot of people might be having this problem, is if you depict something, doesn't necessarily mean that you're promoting it or endorsing it. And if you take something like a clash on set, like, you know, I did a picture of the something like, I can't remember exactly what it was called, but the relationship between the camera crew and the sound recordist. The relationship between the electricians and the grips, let's say, and, you know, which when the pictures are blown up into very, very large conflicts with film equipment used as weapons and all the rest of it. But yes, I would hope the irony was there, but there was a spectacular moment when one rather angry person decided it wasn't and tried to get in a large amount of other people involved to say what a terrible human being I was and how awful my pictures. It was very, I laugh about it now.
But I love art.
The time, it was rather disturbing.
But it's art though, isn't it? And I think I think we talked about this last time and time before that, like that your education being that you're an art, fine art, even though that you work in more of a commercial setting where there is such an image and a product, that your brain from years and years ago, you still have that very artistic sort of vision. And those are, I would say,
hope so.
And those could go into a gallery. These could go into an exhibition, because they are pieces of work that reflect the relationships and the struggles and the conflicts that happen on a filmmaking set.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's that as earlier we discussed it. It's that moment where to do something for the joy of doing, rather than being it's to snatch a moment of pure delight and creativity out of this thing of what times can feel like a very scheduled, time orientated, slightly factory like production, actually to make something that I own and the crew own.
Exactly. Yeah. And so, moving slightly towards the end of our episode, we do this thing where we do a give back to our audience. And I'd love to know what kind of mantra or inspiration or something that you learned coming up in your life that you would reflect and you might be have a quiet word of yourself for the future. Or something that you learned, a mistake that you might have like not made again. What would you give back to our audience?
Okay, thank you for asking this. I think you spoke about the moving mainly from music videos to mainly commercials. I can look back and I realized that I went for the comfort of having enough equipment, enough crew, and being paid a decent amount of money. I went to that cozy, complacent world a little too quickly. That whilst getting paid a decent amount of money for what you do is important, but it's also, one has to, if one can, continually reinvest in pieces that are for the showreel, mm-hmm. for yourself, that it, whilst it is all about the money, it isn't all about the money. Mm. I also realized that I burdened myself. I shouldn't be saying any of this. I burdened myself with too many financial obligations, mainly to do with moving house too many times. And that can become a bit of a millstone of having to do a certain amount of work, et cetera, et cetera. However much it is lovely to do, I'm extremely lucky and grateful and all the rest of it. So those would be my advice for younger DOPs. I just would, the thing what is very interesting, we spoke a little bit about in terms of the pictures, it's about ego.
Which everyone has.
What can happen is, and I see it happen to myself, it happened to other people's, and it happens now and then and all the rest of it. So we live, it's an industry that is very much interested in the new and not so interested in the old. That's fine, but it's very interested in the new. So people can be promoted up very quickly, and we can all tend to lose perspective on this. And it is very easy to behave like a prick because everyone's telling you how absolutely marvelous you are. You're being flown around the world. You're being paid, nice amounts of money. And it takes enormous, you'd have to be an absolute saint not to go down. There's the route of reasonable, nice human being and the road pointing to total bell end. It was very few people managed to do the reasonable route. You need a strong ego at work because you need to say, okay, what can I bring to this story? How can I prioritize? How can I
bring your own vision.
Bring it. How can I shape it to the best possible outcome for all, for the entire piece? But you sometimes will be coming up against producers, assistant directors, all other kind of people in order to do that. So you need a strong ego in order to turn up. You get off an aeroplane, you've never met the director before, you've never met anyone, you're shooting in an entirely new place in a new country and have to establish what you're doing with the job. So you need to have a sense of presence, a sense of self and all the rest of it, but that can also get rather poisoned and twisted. You can make the mistake of thinking it's all about you. I can think back to, I think it was 97 or 98, and I pissed off Chris Cunningham, Alexander McQueen, and a very successful commercials director, all within 1 year, because essentially I couldn't see the wood for the trees. I thought the process was about me, but it wasn't. I was merely one of a number of people. I made that confusion, and now I try, although it is hard when I'm tired and hungry, and sometimes I can be a little bit of a bastard. And try and keep control of that ego.
But
as Morrissey said, it takes strength to be gentle and kind, and unfortunately sometimes I'm not quite strong enough. It's Carla in Cheers says to the character played by Woody Harrelson, once you've mastered the power, use it only for good. We have to try. I often fail, but one has to try.
Yeah, it's like that story. I'm sure everyone has remembered that kind of Roman general emperor leader who would have that the servant behind him saying, "You're only a man, you're only a man."
Yes. It was on the triumph when Caesar would come back from campaigning, having trashed the Gauls and the Goths. There would be the slave behind him holding the laurel wreath, who would be whispering words of his mortality and presumably telling him, Caesar, that his wife had been having an affair or whatever, you know, just to bring in a little humiliation. The marvelous thing is, though, that you can look around, having said something preposterous or behaved in preposterous, and this, you can see the faces of the people you're around and think, yes, they think I'm a twat. I probably am a twat. Just before we go, I just realized there's something. Sorry to go back to experience, and I'm dragging this on a little bit too long.
No, carry on.
It's just that thing, because it's. I remember I was very lucky. I've shot a number of things with a guy called Garth Jennings, a director, and he said that when he started off, he has three stages. You don't really know anything. You know a moderate amount. You think you know everything. He said, you don't know anything. Therefore, you don't want to show that you don't know anything. So you don't ask anyone's advice and you won't take anyone's advice. Then you're in the middle part, where you're comfortable with what you know and what you don't know. So you're more relaxed about letting people help you. Then there's a stage where you think you're an absolute monumental genius and you don't need anyone's advice at all because you know everything. But it's actually the middle state that is the most perfect state. I spoke to you before about this. You can do your most interesting work when you don't quite know. When you start off, you can be scared of what you don't know. But then later on, the possibly more dangerous is being scared of what you do know. And it is worthwhile within your work occasionally doing things that make you feel a little bit uncertain. But then I went on to say that when you start off, you are scared of what you don't know. And then later on, when you become more experienced, you're afraid of what you do know. And it's often at that point when you are inexperienced that you can do your more interesting work. And it's the struggle is to carry on doing the interesting work when you accumulate more experience. It's a joy to be having. I mean, I shot my first role in 1985. I shot my first proper commercial in January 97. All that experience is wonderful. Because it means that you can, if there's some kind of problem, you can come up with a really quick fix on it, that you things that you become very, very instinctive. But it also means can mean that you can get a little bit lazy. So it's like trying to maintain energy and enthusiasm. Just I have there is a phenomenon on set which if a director is anxious about something, they love to see the anxiety reflected in those, some people, not all, they love to see the anxiety reflected on those around them. And sometimes I'm enormously lucky that working, I work with people that are older than myself and way younger than myself. And there's times when I can see someone's fearful and they look at you. And they think somehow that because you're not fearful as well, that you're not taking it seriously.
I find that strange, but I've always believed that I need to keep really, really calm because if someone's flapping their wings, they don't want to see someone else flapping their wings. They want someone else to keep calm with it.
Well, yes, that would be my take on it, but I've often seen the reverse. One of the most amusing things that's happened, well, not me, it's not, but. What can happen? You say, okay, this is the shot. And so I go, no. This is the shot. Now, you can stand and have a discussion for a long time about why this is the shot or that is a shot, but you also might be looking at the sun starting to go down, down, and down, and you've still got eight shots to do. So it's often I'll go, okay, that's the shot. Now, you would think that some people would be saying, oh, that's good there. But what I've noticed is some people say, oh, so you obviously don't have any integrity at all. You're capitulated immediately. And now I'm really worried that you don't care about the job because you didn't argue and fight for this and you disagreed immediately on that.
Yeah, but
it's it's a really interesting, it's a really interesting phenomena. I sometimes think, well, do you know what? Maybe that is better. Let's just go over there and take a look. If you don't make a fight about it, if you say, no, the shot is this, it's over here, it's my right hand, it's not the left hand, there's no way it's the left hand, then you're getting everyone's egos involved. So you literally you can just say, okay, well, let's try the left hand. And sometimes you'll say, do you know what? That person was right. It is the left hand. Sometimes that person will say, oh, do you know what? I think he was right. Maybe it's the right hand. If you don't try, if you try not to put any barriers up to it, then these things will sort themselves out very, very quickly.
Yeah, I just, I think it's all that kind of massaging egos. And I'm like, I've always just believed that you just try things. It doesn't matter whose idea it is. You just go, well, let's just try left. If it doesn't work, let's go right. I mean, I don't need to own the right. I don't need to own the left. I just go.
Exactly.
That's what it is. Well, I want to say thank you very much for coming on 360 Yourself, because it's been absolutely amazing. We spoke about some brilliant things and a great insight into kind of filmmaking in your process, and also about massaging egos and anxiety, which I think a lot of people can relate to when they're working on films and they're working, but even in any sort of kind of creative adventure, that we're always sort of like in between multiple different personalities and always balancing the room with energy. So I want to say thank you very much for coming on our show on 360, but just sharing your insight.
Thank you ever so much, Jamie. Thanks for giving me the opportunity, and I hope the glitches can be glitched out. But thank you for your time. Thank you for giving me a second pop at it as well. Very, very much appreciated.
This is 360 Yourself, and I'm Jamie Neal. Thank you very much for taking a moment to listen to our wonderful guests. Please subscribe to our podcast to access all our brilliant guest episodes. They are released every Sunday at 12 p.m. We are available on all listening platforms: Spotify, Pocket Casts, Overcast, Google Podcasts, and Castro. You can also find us on Instagram at 360_yourself, Twitter at yourself360, and our host at Jamie Neal JN. Thank you for listening.